So I'm going to be presenting to you social network data, like Suzanne did, but from the opposite perspective. I'm going to be presenting sociometric data this morning, not egocentric data, and we'll get into a little bit what the distinction of that is in just a moment. I also have no financial relationships or conflicts of interest to disclose. All right. So the goals of this presentation this morning are threefold. First, I'm going to talk about social influence on a dyadic level and how that can expand when we're thinking about relationships forming into larger social networks that extend beyond particular individuals. I'm going to discuss how it is that you can sample these unbounded populations, which is definitely a very complicated and tricky business. And then talk finally about how HIV risk is located within social networks of homeless youth and some prevention programming suggestions, which I have as a result of these data. To give you a brief context about homelessness among youth in the United States, there are approximately 2 million runaway and homeless youth in the United States. HIV prevalence is incredibly high among this population. It ranges from 2 to about 11%, depending on the surveillance study that you look at. All of those surveillance studies are really old, unfortunately, and we need a new one, but that's another story for another time. Los Angeles right now, in the point-in-time estimates, they believe that there's about 4,200 young people on the streets on any given night between the ages of 15 and 24. I just got finished doing a study with the Los Angeles Public Schools, which indicates that there's about 38,000 high school students who have at least one night of homelessness each year. And we're not talking about couch surfing here. We're talking about sleeping on the streets, being in a shelter, staying with a stranger. It's a huge problem in Los Angeles. So one of the things that we know about peer influence, particularly as Dr. Wenzel pointed out in her last presentation among homeless men, which has been relatively understudied, but among homeless youth, this has actually been the focus of study for about 15 years, the idea that risk is associated with risk. So young people who have risk-taking peers are themselves going to be risky. And all of this data has been collected with the sorts of data that Dr. Wenzel presented earlier, which is looking at self-reports from homeless youth when they're talking about their perceptions of their social networks. And it's only rarely been done with some qualitative data where people are looking at some ethnographic accounts of homeless youth. And really never has it been looked at in a sociometric perspective, which is one where we can look at if young people have relationships with one another, and we look at their each one of them reporting on their own sexual behaviors, are the people who are congregating together really risk-taking in clusters? So if you want to expand the egocentric perspective to a sociometric perspective, there's actually several different ways in which this could play out. And what I'm going to present here is four different hypothetical networks for you, just to give you a sense of what, from a theoretical perspective, risk-taking could look like in a large network. In all of these hypothetical networks, the average person is connected to three other people. And so this first network I refer to as the small clusters network with local risk. So what you see here, it's pretty straightforward. You know, the in each of the slides that I'm going to show you in the next couple minutes, we're going to look at the dots are going to be persons, the lines are going to be the connections among those people, and the red dots will represent people who are risk takers, and the gray dots will represent people who are not risk takers. So here what you see is we've got a bunch of small clusters, and we've got risk taking occurring in some clusters. This is one way that it could play out. And this is the way that I find to be least worrisome, because as you can imagine, although risk happens within these clusters, it becomes localized and it doesn't spread very easily because there aren't many social contacts among those clusters. This is a more worrisome sort of social network. This would be a chain. So again, here you have a small number of dyadic relationships linking together in an extended chain, and you have this localized regions of space where you have risk occurring. Now, this is a third possibility, and this is a lot like what a high school would look like. So what you have is you have some number of people who are isolates from this social network, people that aren't particularly social. Then you have a large number of people who are popular, who are integrated into the core. And then you have people who are hangers-on and peripheral members. And when you look at normative populations of youth, you tend to have risk-taking occurring at the periphery, as you do in this diagram. So what happens is that, yes, although there are risk-takers congregate with one another, they tend to be marginalized in these social systems. Now, this is the most worrisome network that you could have, which is this very same network structure, but now risk is reversed. Instead of risk being at the periphery of these networks, what you have is risk concentrated at the core. So now you have a lot of normative reinforcement of this risk, and you have a great potential for dissemination of this risk. Whereas in the previous network, you have the normative behaviors are actually fighting against the risk-taking. So the question then is, what does the network of homeless youth look like? It looks like this. I will get into the details of this in a minute, but before I get into how to collect this data and all these other things, I wanted to give you at least a peek at what the answers are going to be. So what you see here is really a hybrid between the first model and the fourth model. So what we have here is this core periphery structure that I was talking about in the previous slide. You've got a lot of risk-taking happening at the core of this network. But we also have a fair number of these small clusters where also you can see in some of those clusters there's low risk going on, and in some of those clusters there's high risk going on. In this case, the risk behavior that I'm indicating here with the red dots is people who reported having unprotected sex at their last sexual encounter. Okay, so why have we not had this kind of data before? Well, we've not had this kind of data before because it's really hard to collect this kind of data. And really the problem surrounds this idea of collecting data from an unbounded population. So homeless youth, as you can imagine, they're a very transient group. They don't have memberships that we can use, and so it becomes a very difficult group of young people in order to survey. So really, when you're thinking about network science in general, one of the things that you need to keep in mind is that the old Stanley Milgram idea of the 6 degrees of separation, if you take enough ties that connect us to one another, we're all connected to one another. But when you're thinking about network science, you have to make some decisions about where's the boundary of this population going to be so that then you can say, okay, these are the people that count in my population and these are the people that don't count. So the data that Dr. Wenzel presented, in some sense, is thinking more about the Stanley Milgram way of thinking about things, where you're thinking about who are the people in your personal network, tell me all about them, they could be anywhere, I don't care. When you're thinking about sociometric data, you need to think about who is this population. So there's three ways that you can think about bounding a population. One is this positional approach. This is the most popular way of getting this kind of data. This is great for school settings. What you have is you have a list. So here's a classroom of students. Those are the people in our population. That could work if you were thinking about only sampling homeless youth within the context of, say, a shelter. But if you want to get street-dwelling youth, this isn't going to work for you. Okay, next approach, network expansion. So network expansion, this is respondent-driven sampling, which I'm sure all of you have heard about before, is the most popular version of this these days. What you do is you start with a group of seeds or a small list of people, and through some criterion of relationship, like a sex partner or a friend or a drug-using partner, you expand from those initial seeds to their network members, to their network members, to their network members, to their network members, until you have this long, sprawling, interconnected chain of relationships. The problem with that method for homeless youth is that you lose out on all the isolates. And one thing that if you've ever spent any time in drop-in centers or lunch lines where homeless youth congregate, you see that there's a lot of homeless youth who are connected with one another, but there's always homeless youth who come and access these services but really stay themselves apart from the rest of that population. And so if you were to use this network expansion method, you would never get those young people, and they're an important part of the population. So we're left with the third approach, which is the event-based approach, which in some senses is actually the simplest approach, but is also in some respects the diciest approach. And this, what you do is you have to define some sort of physical social event that's going to be your sampling frame. And then you go into that physical space and time and social space and time, and you get everyone that you can. So how does this work? Well, it was originally developed with the context of a beach community. And so what happened was Linton Freeman, who's one of these godfathers of social network analysis from the 70s, he decided he wanted to sample a beach community. And so what he did was he hung out at a beach, stretch of beach, defined it by this literal physical space, hung out there for a month, thought to himself, well, people that come here once or twice a month don't really count as part of my community. I'm going to count people that are here three or more times. And so he then went and interviewed everybody who came the next month three or more times. I used a similar approach. This time, my beach is a drop-in center. So drop-in centers become a great beach, if you will, for homeless youth, because essentially these are low-barrier places where homeless youth are coming for services, particularly for food services. So you've got the whole spectrum of homeless youth from street-living young people who just need something to eat but won't engage in any other sorts of services, to young people that are in transitional living programs who still need food but also are looking for the continued connection to the case managers that they've been working with for years. And so you get the entire spectrum of homeless youth when you go to these drop-in centers. And it fulfills the basic requirements. So you've got patterns of ongoing social networks that you can observe. You have clusters of youth who interact over time, but there's no predefined groups. I mean, these are people who are freely associating with one another however they want. And most importantly, you have free entry and exit into these systems. So what we decided to do was to just define our community in this sense by any homeless youth that came into one drop-in center over the course of a six-week period and who had been there at least one other time. So we did this for a little less than 2 months. We sampled 140 youth. By the end of the day, we had 136 youth with complete data. This really is a form of a convenient sample, but it's also an attempt at getting a population. So it's important to keep in mind that when you're looking at social network data, when you're looking at sociometric network data, probability samples won't do you much good because you want to know about everyone. You don't want to know about representative people. You want to know about the population. So, and people's social network ties are anything but random. So it's a very different perspective of looking at a network analysis than the one that Dr. Wenzel just presented. Our refusal rate was only 9%, which is pretty good. Our group was representative of the age, gender, and racial ethnic composition of the clients who came into the agency during the time that we were collecting data. We used a computer-assisted self-interview and an interactive network mapping procedure, which I'll show you in a minute. Our sample was primarily male, primarily youth of color, particularly African-American youth. And for the sake of the risk analysis, we had 80% who were sexually active in the past 90 days. So when we asked people, we used the question from the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, which asks when you had your last sexual intercourse, if you had used a condom or not. And so we had 20% who were not sexually active, 36% who said that they had used a condom, and 43% that said that they had not. Okay, so how do we get this network data? Well, essentially what we did was we went and collected egocentric social network data from individuals, and we gave them a very open-ended name generator. So you can see the exact text here, but really we were asking people to tell us about the wide spectrum of ties that they had. So we used language that we had pre-tested with the young people and gotten them to help us come up with it. So people that you talk to, people you hang out with, kick it with, chill with, people you hook up with, people you have sex with, people that you party with, people that you drink or use drugs with. As people started to list out names, we would write down the names. As they started to peter out in their listing of names, we then had these 15 other prompts that ranged everything from caseworkers, old friends from home that you're communicating with on the phone or by email, your baby mom or your baby daddy, so the whole wide spectrum of things that homeless youth are going to, people who they could be interacting with. And these are the maps that we generated. So we actually used this really fun procedure. Well, I think it's fun. Some of my staff is here. They can tell you if they actually think it's fun or not. The young people seem to like it, too. So we actually draw out a map for them, and I've removed the names from the circles, but we would actually write down their names in the circles. So this is a young person who has a relatively small network. This is a young person who has a much larger network. And what we did was we created a matrix of ties that links all of these maps together. So I'm going to use a hand gesture that one of my staff members uses. So we're going to link all these maps together. So the way that we link all these maps together is through a basic set of criteria. So we use the names that they use, the nicknames, the approximate age, the race, the gender, and the fact that they were described as another client of this agency. So then you're left with the problem of most of the time you've got a lot of street names that help people identify who they are. You don't have too many people who are exactly the same on all of these criteria. But in a few cases, we had some people who were only known as someone like Mike. And there were two guys who were Mike. They were both African American. They were both about 20 years old. They were both clients of the agency. Which Mike is which? Well, what we used was the presence of a third tie that was co-nominated in order to decide whether or not this was Mike number one or Mike number two. So if Bill's talking about Mike and Eric's talking about Mike and Eric and Bill are also talking about popcorn, then it's the same Mike. If they weren't talking, if one of them was talking about popcorn and another guy never mentioned somebody named popcorn, then we thought that they were a different Mike. I had two research assistants who independently coded the network ties based on all 136 maps. It took them months of full-time labor. They nearly went blind. It was not kind, but they were diligent, and they only had two discrepant ties in the end, so we had 99.9% agreement across this 18,000 possible ties, which I was incredibly, I was actually shocked. I thought I was going to have like 10% disagreement, but it turns out that the young people, when you, their networks are relatively sparse, and when they're talking about one another, the concurrency of these little groups and the shared relationships that they have are so great that you actually have a much easier time linking them together than one might think at first blush, particularly because these are all young people who are coming to one drop-in center. And so, and the people who coded the data also went and did the interviews initially, which is an important part of this methodology. And so when they're looking at these maps and you know, Mike is talking about popcorn, they actually remember Mike and popcorn coming in together. And so they remember, oh yeah, that day those two people came in together, they're matched, no problem. So it's a little bit easy, well, I mean, it's painstaking months of work to do this, but it's doable and it's relatively reliable data. So we'll come back how much time do I have left? Oh, great. I'm talking faster than I thought. You should maybe slow me down a little bit. So let's go back to the data and think about this a little bit more in detail. So what I have here in this map is I have two things which I want to talk about. First is the shapes. So the diamonds represent young people who've been homeless for less than 2 years, and the circles represent young people who've been homeless for 2 years or more. The red dots represent those young people who reported having unprotected intercourse at their last sexual encounter. The gray dots are those young people who reported using condoms, and the white dots are youth who reported being not sexually active in the previous 90 days. So one thing that you can think about when you're looking at this is, okay, well now Eric's got a structure, a network structure, and we didn't have network structures before, and that's interesting, and we can even qualitatively and relatively intuitively see that there's a lot more risk going on in these more central positions, and it seems like the things that are going on in, around the isolates and maybe around the edges are not quite as risky. But how do we really quantify this? So the way that we quantify this is through a network metric that's actually a relatively simple network metric called a K-core. And the way that a K-core works is it's a sub-network within a network where all the members of that core are connected to a minimum of K other members in that network. Now, for those of you who don't do network science, you might think, okay, Eric just said blah, 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 and that's fine. But simply put, if you have a K-core of 0, this means that you're an isolate. If you have a K-core of 1, that means that you're only connected to a region in this map to one other person. So what we decided to do in this analysis was we were really interested in defining the periphery of that network, because when I looked at this periphery, I thought to myself, okay, there's a lot of not sexually active and condom-using young people amongst this set of isolates who are over here on the far left, and I'm also seeing a lot of white and gray dots amongst these people who are relatively peripheral in this network space that are in the connected network space. And so those are really the people that I wanted to try to capture, because I was, at least qualitatively, I was thinking that was what was going on. So we defined our periphery in this case as people that were in the core 0 or 1, and people who are in the K-core 2 or higher are people that are in the non-periphery or in the core, if you want. And so this actually breaks the network almost in half. So when we go to the multivariate modeling, what we can see is I've presented two different models here. One is looking at who is it that's part of this periphery, and then the second model is looking at who is it that's had unprotected sex at their most recent sexual encounter. So the first thing that we see here is that there are two demographic issues that are important in terms of who ended up in the periphery. First of all, male youth were more likely to be in the periphery, which therefore means that females are more likely to be in the core. And if you were homeless for two or more years, you were much less likely to be in the periphery or more likely to be in the core. And I'll come back to the implications of these in a minute. The thing that I found to be most exciting for this analysis was the idea that people who were not in the periphery were 2.2 times more likely to have had unprotected sexual intercourse. So this isn't your perception of what your friends are doing. This isn't, this is, if you are connected to other young people who are having unprotected sex, whether you know that they're having unprotected sex or not, you are a part of a community where unprotected sex is normative, and you're much more likely to be having unprotected sex than if you are part of the periphery of this network space. So the summary points around this data really revolve around a couple of things. First of all, what we have is a large network that has this core periphery structure, and that there are many of these small clusters that exist as well. So really it's that hybrid between the first and the fourth hypothetical models that I was talking about. And it's important to remember that there's a lot of isolates. And this is really, I think, for myself, why I'm most happy that I decided to go with that third approach. Because if I had gone with the network expansion approach, which had been my first inclination in some respects, I would have missed about a third of the network. And as you could see also in the results, it was people who were in that isolated or peripheral space who are the least risk-taking. So that's an important thing. And I think I'll credit my co-author, Anamika, who's in the audience with this. She had a great insight as we were looking at this data one day, and she said, well, what it is that being marginalized in a marginalized network is actually a healthy thing. And so we often think about the fact that people who are in marginalized social positions, people who are living in poverty, people who are homeless, people who are, young people of color, like these are young people who are typically disproportionately engaged in risk-taking. But what we have here is we have an entire population that is a marginalized population. And if you are marginal to this marginalized population, you're actually healthier. And I think that the fact that there were young people who had been homeless for shorter periods of time that were disproportionately a part of that periphery is suggestive of this overtime process for marginalization. So what happens is, at least this is my hypothesis, and we're collecting overtime data now using this method to try to see if this is actually the truth, but I think that this is suggestive of this idea that young people start off relatively healthy when they first hit the streets, and they're relatively peripheral to this large street network, and as they become part of homeless life over time and they become embedded in these larger networks, they become more increasingly a part of this normative space where this risk-taking is occurring, and their health behaviors are likewise compromised by their engagement in these marginalized, unhealthy networks. So quickly, a couple of limitations to this study. First of all, the data are cross-sectional. So my causal story that I just gave you that I think is actually true, I have no evidence to support it yet, but we will have it in the next couple of years. The EBA, the event-based approach, it's imperfect. I mean, no boundary solution problem is a perfect boundary solution problem. One can certainly give me a hard time about, why I didn't do an RDS or some other sort of thing like this. I feel that this was a good method because it accomplishes a lot of theoretically relevant goals, but it's certainly not the only one. And we also, if the young person never comes into the agency, we're not going to have them in our network. So there are certainly young people who are parts of these street networks who don't end up in this final analysis. And of course, the data is self-report data, so young people can always be lying to us about whether or not they're having safe sex. So the last thing that I want to talk about, and I'll spend just about a minute on this, and I'd be happy to talk more about this in the question and answer session, is, so where does this take us? Okay, right now, in the field of HIV prevention research, we've got two network-based models that people are really excited about. One is the POL model and one is the SHIELD model. I think that these data suggest that for this population and any other population that has a network structure like this, POL is actually a bad idea. And the reason for that is that you had a third of the population that were completely isolated, and then you had another about 15% that were in those small clusters. The way that POL works is you identify the most popular people in a space, You train 10 or 15% of the most popular people in that space, and you have them disseminate to their relation in their relationships these norm-changing messages. So more than about half the network's going to be missed if you use a POL model. Shield, on the other hand, is a model that works more in localized regions and space, so you can be thinking more carefully about trying to get a couple of people that are going to be in those clusters that are isolated from the larger component. And also, a lot of the shield action, they're trained to be more deliberate outreach workers as opposed to people communicating about norms within their ongoing social relationships. So there's more of an active attempt at engaging folks who would be in this isolated positions. So I think that if one is to engage in a peer-driven model, which I certainly have talked to a lot of community-based organizations who work with homeless youth who are interested in peer modeling around HIV prevention for homeless youth, because homeless youth are so distrustful of adults, my suggestion is that you go with the shield model if you think that your population is going to be looking like mine in Hollywood. So thank you to my collaborators and to the youth of Hollywood.